President Biden is pitching his infrastructure plan today. He says his $2 trillion bill will juice the economy by creating jobs.
How will he sell it to lawmakers?
You get a bridge and you get a road. It's the Oprah of infrastructure.
I'm Rachel Martin with Noel King, and this is Up First from NPR News. Day two of Derek Chauvin's murder trial included more emotional testimony from witnesses.
It's not what I should have done. It's what he should have done.
Including the teenage girl who recorded George Floyd's death. Who will the jury hear from today?
And COVID cases are surging again in India and Pakistan. Scientists say people there are getting reinfected, and there are signs of a new double mutation with traits from multiple variants. What's all that mean? Stick with us. We get the news you need to start your day.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Salesforce, dedicated to helping growing businesses connect their teams, share information, and automate processes all in a single app. Learn more at salesforce.com/SMB.
Support also comes from NPR sponsor HubSpot, whose CRM platform makes it easy to scale, helping marketing, sales, and service teams create delightful customer experiences, align with ease, generate leads, and accelerate sales all on one platform. Learn more at HubSpot.com.
Later today, President Biden will unveil his ambitious $2 trillion infrastructure plan.
He'll make his pitch at a Pittsburgh facility where aspiring carpenters take on apprenticeships that often turn into union jobs. The plan is going to focus on physical infrastructure, bridges, roads, sewer systems, and expanding broadband, among other things. Biden characterizes it as a jobs plan that he hopes will transform the economy.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here with some details. Hey, Tam.
Good morning.
So what's in this plan? What do we know?
Well, they're calling it the American Jobs Plan, as you guys said, about $2 trillion. You know, the transit, bridges, roads, broadband into rural areas. Also, a big spending on the electric grid and sewer and water systems. You know, think about what happened in Texas earlier this year or what happened in Flint, Michigan, trying to avoid those types of things. Upgrading housing, schools, hospitals. A lot of focus on union jobs and helping underserved communities, both rural and urban. You know, it specifically talks about trying to entice manufacturers to areas affected by a loss of coal jobs, and helping address racial inequities by reconnecting neighborhoods that were cut off by previous highway building. This sweeping proposal is only part one, though. Next month, Biden is set to propose investments in healthcare, childcare, and education.
There is a lot in part one that's worth digging into, but I am curious, why are we only hearing about the first part today?
Yeah, so historically, infrastructure was an area where Democrats and Republicans in Congress actually worked well together, and there is a widespread acknowledgement that there's a big backlog that needs to be addressed. Former Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat from North Dakota, told me that infrastructure can be an easier sell because there's something tangible for every lawmaker to tell their constituents about.
You get a bridge and you get a bridge and you get a bridge and you get a road and you get a hospital. It's the Oprah of infrastructure.
No, she said that for Republicans and even some moderate Democrats, the key will be having this proposal remain targeted. But this is a very expensive and expansive proposal. It has a lot of elements. A lot of them are really popular ideas, though. Reverend William Barber from the Poor People's Campaign, who delivered a sermon at the inauguration, says Biden needs to go big, and he's told him that, that he needs to be more ambitious than FDR's New Deal, just given the depth of suffering exposed and created by the pandemic.
Where you do the roads, but you don't prioritize rural and urban areas, or you do the bridges, but you don't look at environmentally sustainable infrastructure jobs, and the healthcare, and the public health infrastructure, and the training, and the capacity. It's not or, it's and. It's and.
And it's $2 trillion. And how does the Biden administration propose paying for all of it?
They want to roll back some of the tax cuts that Republicans and President Trump pushed through in 2017 for corporations and place more taxes on companies that move profits overseas. Their proposal would put the corporate tax rate at 28%. That is still historically low, but about halfway back to where it was before the Trump tax cuts. And also, there's this idea that Democrats are pushing that you don't need to get hung up on paying for it dollar for dollar because infrastructure investment pays for itself. Mm. That will certainly be a debate.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Key. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
All right. This morning, witnesses will again testify in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin.
Yesterday, jurors heard from eyewitnesses, including a 9-year-old girl and her teenage cousin, who recorded George Floyd's death on her cell phone.
NPR's Cheryl Corley is in Minneapolis this morning covering the trial. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Tell us about the testimony of Darnella Frazier. She was the teenage girl who recorded George Floyd's killing and then posted the video. What did she say?
Well, she really talked about walking, first of all, to the neighborhood corner grocery store with her younger cousin, the 9-year-old that you mentioned, and seeing George Floyd on the ground under Officer Chauvin's knee. And she said Floyd was saying he couldn't breathe. He was calling for help and for his mother. She sent her little cousin inside the store, and she stayed outside to record what she saw happening. And the court ruled that no video of her testimony could be allowed since she was a minor at the time. But according to the pool reporter who was in the courtroom, Frazier just had tears streaming down her face as she told her story. And she said when she thinks about George Floyd, she thinks about her father, her brother, her other relatives, all Black, and how what happened to Floyd could also happen to them.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting and not saving his life. But it's like, it's not what I should have done. It's what he should have done.
And Frazier just turned 18. She was 17 at the time of that encounter with Floyd and Chauvin. And three other minors testified, her cousin, the 9-year-old, and two other young people as well.
How did the defense cross-examine a crying teenager and a small child? How did that process go?
Well, they stayed away a lot from the younger people, not okay. asking them many questions. It was other folks that they, the adults that they tried to portray as bystanders, as people who were angry and interfering with police trying to do their job. There were several videos played that were showing people calling for Officer Chauvin to get off Floyd's neck. And in one of those videos, Genevieve Hansen, she's a Minneapolis firefighter and a trained emergency medical technician, she moved closer to the officers and demanded that they check Floyd's pulse. And during the trial, defense attorney Eric Nelson asked her and others testifying whether they just weren't angry people who were becoming threatening to police. So listen to this exchange between him and Hansen after he says it took her just a short amount of time to become louder and frustrated and upset.
Frustrated, I'm not sure is the word I would use.
Angry?
More desperate.
You called the officers a right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got quite angry after Mr. Floyd was loaded into the ambulance and there was no point in trying to reason with them anymore because they had just killed somebody.
There is a lot of emotion in this testimony. We're hearing it. What has the mood of witnesses been during this trial?
Well, it's pretty much run the gamut from sadness to anger, but most of them just seem to have a feeling of helplessness and really wishing that they could have done more.
What has Derek Chauvin been doing as people testify?
You know, for the most part, Derek Chauvin sits at the defense table and takes notes, and that's just been what's been visible on the video. Don't have much more to know beyond that at this point.
And so, Cheryl, you'll be watching today following the testimony. What do you expect?
Genevieve Hansen was the last witness yesterday, and she'll be back on the witness stand today.
NPR's Cheryl Corley in Minneapolis. Thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
Coronavirus infections in India and Pakistan are surging.
But until just last month, there had been a dramatic drop in cases. The sudden change has scientists investigating two mysteries. Why did cases in India and Pakistan drop in the first place, and why are they surging now?
NPR India correspondent Lauren Freyer is with us now from Mumbai. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
What's the situation in Mumbai like?
Mumbai is seeing its highest caseload since the start of the pandemic, worse than last spring when India imposed a total nationwide lockdown. Right now, we're under local curfew here, but not a lockdown yet, in part because of how damaging it was last time. India's economy shrank nearly 24% last spring and summer. And so authorities are trying to avoid that. Commerce is still open. Big gatherings, though, are banned. I mean, last weekend, pretty much the Indian festival of Holi, this colorful festival, was basically canceled. And this has all come as a shock to a lot of folks because until recently, as you mentioned, cases had dropped here to about a tenth of what they once were.
Which was the first mystery Rachel mentioned. What are scientists telling you about why cases dropped that dramatically?
So last summer and fall, random testing in India's biggest cities showed about half of people here had antibodies. So what we thought was that many people had had COVID already, many of them asymptomatically, and thus had some protection.
Okay, so that may be why cases declined. People already had antibodies, had protection, but then why would they be spiking now?
Well, that's the big question. I called up a virologist, Dr. Gagandeep Kang. She says it looks like this wave is straining private hospitals more than public ones. So these could be affluent Indians who've maybe let their guard down.
People who were previously able to isolate themselves and stay away from getting infected are now out and about and more likely to be infected.
Or, Dr. Kang says, this might be people who are getting reinfected.
Now we've reached a stage where previously infected people cannot ward off infection anymore.
So essentially, like, too much time may have passed for those folks who were sick last year to still have protection. And she says there could be another explanation, too, new variants. Last week, India said it's detected one they're calling a double mutant, so with two different mutations.
Just quickly, Lauren, what is India doing about this?
Trying to vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible. Starting tomorrow, India is opening up shots to anyone over the age of 45. India is lucky in a way that it's the world's biggest vaccine producer. So supply isn't an issue here. I actually visited an Indian factory a couple weeks ago that's churning out 100 million doses a month. But India also has nearly 1.4 billion people, and it just takes time to get those shots into all those arms. And other countries in the region have smaller populations, but they don't have the supply. Neighboring Pakistan is importing millions of doses from China, and they're also seeing a huge surge. Even the prime minister has it there. Hospitals are stretched, and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan is less than 2 weeks away.
NPR's Lauren Freyer in Mumbai. Thank you, Lauren.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's up first for Wednesday, March 31st. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Come back tomorrow. We'll be right here. And you know what? If you got some free time, you should check out the Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's NPR's daily podcast about what to watch, read, and listen to. On the latest episode, the epic battle of two movie monsters, the new film Godzilla versus Kong.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.